This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. قل إن تخفوا ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما ويحذركم الله نفسه والله رؤوف بالعباد صدق
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel steps up its crackdown in the occupied West Bank amid heightened tensions following a Palestinian operation outside a settlement. The Ain al-Assad military base housing U.S. troops in western Iraq once again comes under a rocket attack. Also in headlines, the Canadian police step up their presence in the capital Ottawa to counter a new wave of anti-government protests. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Badr Zanjafik. Good to have you with us. The Israeli military has a stepped up security crackdown in the occupied West Bank after a guard outside the settlement of Ariel was shot dead on Friday. The military says it has conducted new search operations in Palestinian villages. Israeli forces also raided the home village of the suspects behind the incident. The military says both suspects have been arrested. Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, the armed wing of the Fatah faction, has claimed responsibility for the shooting. The group says the attack was in response to Israeli violations in Al-Quds that injured nearly 300 Palestinians over 2 weeks. The regime's forces also killed a Palestinian in an operation they claim was linked to the hunt for the attackers. Two rockets target a base hosting U.S.-led coalition troops in western Iraqi province of Al-Anbar. According to security sources, the projectiles crashed near the Ain al-Assad complex without causing any casualty or damage. A group calling itself International Resistance says it was behind the attack. U.S. troops and interests in Iraq have frequently come under rocket and drone strikes in recent months. Anti-U.S. sentiment sharply increased in Iraq after January 2020, and that's when the U.S. assassinated Iran's anti-terror commander, General Soleimani, and Iraqi commander al-Mohandas in a drone strike near Baghdad Airport. Now, within days, the Iraqi parliament passed a bill demanding the expulsion of all foreign troops. The coalition ended its combat mission in the country last December, but around 3,500 soldiers remained deployed there in a so-called advisory and training role. The Sudanese capital, Khartoum, is again the scene of protests against the military rule in that country. The crowds blocked a major road junction in the capital for a sit-in where they brought food to break the Ramadan fast. Security forces have reportedly attempted to break up the rally by firing tear gas and chasing them into side streets. Protesters were marking the third anniversary of the killing of scores of demonstrators in the city. Months-long unrest in Sudan led to the ouster of former President Omar al-Bashir in 2019. A power-sharing deal struck between the military and civilians was scrapped in a coup in October last year. Many officials who worked in the former Bashir regime have been allowed to return to civil service or have been released from jail, intensifying people's anger. An explosion targeting a mosque in the African capital, Kabul, killed at least 50 worshippers 2 days ago. Now, the Daesh terrorist group says its operatives were behind the bloodshed. The attack drew many condemnations, including one from the UN that said attacks against civilians are prohibited under international humanitarian law. Also on Saturday, a car bomb explosion in Kabul left one person dead and three wounded. Several back-to-back terrorist attacks in recent weeks have raised security fears on the eve of the Eid al-Fitr, a religious occasion that's celebrated at the end of the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan. Now, in the Canadian capital, an anti-government protest led by bikers has prompted a heavy police presence. The motorcyclists, dubbing the rally Rolling Thunder, are demanding their freedoms and criticizing government policies. On Saturday, many of the demonstrators carried Canadian flags, a symbol of protest, when a rally by truckers against COVID mandates shut down Ottawa for 3 weeks in February. The government eventually invoked extraordinary powers to end what are called the occupation of the city, but authorities say they won't allow the bikers to choke the streets this time. Police saying that they're monitoring social media for intimidating behavior. On Friday night, security forces dismantled what they said was an aggressive and combative crowd. They also made several arrests. The protest action is expected to last through the weekend. The French president says that his country will step up its military and humanitarian support for Ukraine, and that's while Russia is escalating its warnings and criticism. Emmanuel Macron made the announcement in a phone call with his Ukrainian counterpart, Volodymyr Zelensky. Since Russia launched a war against Ukraine, NATO members and allies have provided billions of dollars in military support to Kyiv. The supplied weapons system range from surface-to-air missiles to heavy artillery and surveillance equipment. The U.S. alone has provided $3 billion in aid. In a vast increase to such aid, the U.S. president also called on Congress to provide $33 billion in mostly military assistance for Ukraine. Moscow says the aid fuels the conflict and also risks direct confrontation between Russia and NATO powers. It's warned any attempt to interfere in the war will be met with a swift response from Moscow. French President Macron's first term was defined by the yellow vests. Will the same go for the second term? The anti-government group spent Saturday marching, as usual, knowing that Macron will soon begin 5 more years in office. Rami Mazahari is in Paris with a report.
For the first time since the presidential election, the yellow vests marched around the country, and most expressed disbelief that Emmanuel Macron was re-elected despite his unprecedented repression of the group.
Frankly, we really don't understand how Macron could be re-elected. We started over purchasing power, and it's worse than ever. I guess people need a knife to their throats to come protest anymore?
They were met by a huge police presence, armed to the teeth. The government continues to intimidate yellow vests, but also the average person from rejoining the demonstrations. Intimidating deterrence is also being used to keep journalists from covering the group. In the yellow vest demonstration the day before the first round of voting, a journalist from a top French media was fined for allegedly illegally demonstrating while simply reporting on the yellow vests.
We'll never stop demanding for citizens' referendums, purchasing power, decent pensions, and the ability to have some money left at the end of the month. After the legislative elections in June and the summer vacation, social unrest will explode this fall.
Thousands of devoted yellow vests will continue to turn out every Saturday in Paris alone, and they say others will put their yellow vests back on when they see Macron's plans for his second term.
Emmanuel Macron will continue to be the president of the rich, and will continue to march people will eventually recover their good sense and realize the only way to change politics is to join us in the streets.
Nobody expected the Yellow Vests to stop marching. Now we'll see if they can last for the next 5 years. Global May Day protests will see establishment forces, such as unions and political parties, march nationwide in favor of workers' rights, but also to express major dissatisfaction with the presidential election. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
The concerns rising over North Korean conflict with its southern neighbor, Pyongyang, has warned it might use nuclear weapons to counter enemy forces and maintain superiority of its armed forces. Now, we've discussed the latest developments in the long-running dispute on the Korean Peninsula in our review program. Let's see what our experts had to say.
Welcome, everyone, to the News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. The North Korean leader says his country could preemptively use nuclear weapons to counter hostile forces and maintain what he calls the absolute superiority of its armed forces. Kim Jong-un says that Pyongyang should continue to build up its arsenal to have overwhelming military muscle, which no one can provoke. He says that's the lifeline guaranteeing North Korea's security. Kim was meeting with top military brass. Earlier this week, North Korea held a parade to mark the 90th anniversary of the founding of its armed forces. The parade also featured the country's latest intercontinental ballistic missiles. On that occasion as well, Kim vowed to accelerate the development of North Korea's nuclear arsenal. The country has progressed its nuclear and missile program despite U.S. pressure over the past years. Talks between the two sides have failed to resolve their differences. And now joining us for the program is Frank Smith, correspondent joining us from Seoul, and Andrew K.P. Lang, international and independent strategist, joining us out of Hong Kong. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Hope you're both safe and doing well. Frank, obviously, we're going to start with you to get the latest. What can you tell us?
Well, North Korea just celebrated the 90th anniversary of the Korean People's Revolutionary Army that was established in 1932 by Kim Jong-un's grandfather, who was also the founder of the North Korean state. During that celebration, Kim Jong-un made some remarks about how the nuclear deterrent of North Korea will continue to protect the country and that the country will continue to develop those weapons. We need to be reminded that North Korea's capability of launching an intercontinental ballistic missile, an ICBM, to the United States is not the only aspect of nuclear deterrent that North Korea is developing. It also has submarine-launched ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and hypersonic missiles that can travel between Pyongyang and Seoul in just 90 seconds. So we're seeing North Korea develop other nuclear missile delivery systems as time goes by. North Korea's nuclear threat then is continuing to grow as the U.S. sticks to its position of maintaining United Nations Security Council sanctions that prevent North Korea from trading with the international community and developing its economy. What North Korea wants to see is those sanctions suspended or dropped, negotiations take place, and the country be recognized as a nuclear power and be able to, again, trade and develop its economy like a normal country in the international community.
And Mr. Andrew K.P. Lang, I'm going to allow you to get the final thoughts in, if you could, please. For some time, Beijing was kind of the pseudo-mediator, if we could say that, between Pyongyang and Washington, especially when there were tensions. But now, how much do you think we're impacted by the fact that there are strained ties and strained dialogue between Beijing and Washington, and there's zero dialogue, basically, at the time being, between Pyongyang and Washington?
Well, I think that things have changed quite rapidly. Well, first of all, I'd like to answer this kind of remark in the social media about the trade-off between North Korea's economy and its nuclear arms development. Basically, Kim Jong-un is taking a leaf from Chairman Mao's book. Don't forget that when Chairman Mao established Communist China was extremely poor, but China chose to develop the nuclear bomb rather than developing its economy. And because without the nuclear bomb, China was under great threat from the then USSR, which threatened actually invading China at the time. So Kim Jong-un is taking a leaf from his book. Secondly, as far as South Korea is concerned, North Koreans do not have to resort to nuclear power to deter South Korea, because Seoul, the capital of South Korea, is less than 100 miles from the border with North Korea, and North Korea has deployed, you know, almost hundreds and thousands of cannons. You know, at the drop of a hat, all these cannons can destroy Seoul in a couple of minutes. So I think that this what Kim Jong-un wants to do, of course, obviously, is to deter the South Koreans from allying with the United States and putting pressure on them. But I think it's taking advantage of this opportunity to further their, develop their delivery systems so as to provide a shield for them to further develop the economy to legitimize their regime. But I don't think that unification is the top priority. The main priority is to stabilize the economy, but the first thing before stabilizing this economy is to develop a sufficient deterrence against any foreign coercion.
Thank you, gentlemen. Both of you, your time has gotten the better of us, but I appreciate both of you joining us on the program. Frank Smith, our correspondent out of Seoul, and Mr. Andrew K.P. Lang, international and independent strategist, joining us out of Hong Kong. And that's it for this segment of your News Review program. Hope you enjoyed it. Thanks, and bye-bye for now.
Islamophobia is on the rise around the world, but the most violent attacks on Muslims are being carried out in the West, such as in the U.S. In the meantime, calls are growing for addressing the long-running discrimination and hatred against the faith group.
A recent report by the Council on American-Islamic Relations shows anti-Muslim hate crimes have been on the rise in the United States over the past year. In a news conference following the publication of the report, head of the council, Nihad Awad, described Islamophobia in the United States as deep and systematic.
Islamophobia has become mainstream in America. It made its way into the government's institutions and public sphere through laws, policies, political rhetoric, and other manifestations.
Yeah, Islamophobia has been a huge phenomenon in the U.S. since 2001, when the September 11th false flag operation was deliberately used by enemies of Islam to trigger this tidal wave of hatred of Muslims and Islam that led to a series of wars that killed millions of people.
The report shows that the council received over 6,700 complaints nationwide last year, the highest the organization has recorded in 27 years, which represented a 9% increase since the year before. They involved a range of issues, including immigration, travel discrimination, law enforcement, government overreach, hate and bias, custody rights, school incidents, and free speech. Over 2,800 of the incidents were reportedly travel-related. The report cites last year's tensions in Afghanistan and the ensuing immigration crisis as the reason for such a large figure. The report also cites a 28% increase in complaints of hate and bias incidents, including the forcible removal of hijabs, harassment, vandalism, physical assault, and so on.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
a supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
Ramadan, the month of opportunities. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, Salam and welcome to the program. The blessed month of Ramadan is leaving us little by little. We hope that we will keep what we have gained during the unique hours and moments of this month in the field of spirituality and self-purification. Ramadan is bidding farewell, but we should try to leave ill-temperedness. The Messenger of Mercy, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said to the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, O Ali, there is penitence for every sin except ill-temperedness. An ill-tempered person constantly comes out of a sin and enters another sin. For sure, one of the root causes of ill-temperedness is arrogance and vanity. God says in the Quran that He never likes such people. The Prophet says that most of the Islamic Ummah enters paradise because of God-weariness and good-temperedness. The Prophet also said in his sermon on the blessed month of Ramadan, O people, any of you who improves his temperament in this month will cross the Sirat bridge on the day when all feet sleeps over it. And anyone who restrains his evil from people, God will restrain his wrath from him on the day of resurrection. One of the signs of good-temperedness is to smile when speaking with others. Another sign of good-temperedness is to be humble towards others, to refrain from disturbing others with the tongue. It includes insulting, backbiting, slandering, and other verbal sins. Generosity and spending to solve the problems of others are also among the signs of good-temperedness. According to the Islamic teachings, the best good temperament is to be good-tempered with one's family and wife. Good morals form the bag which we put our deeds in it, and ill-temperedness and aggressiveness wear away that bag and will waste our good morals. In the final episode of this series, we are going to sum up what we said on diet during the blessed month of Ramadan. The reason for breaking the fast or iftar with warm water is to cleanse the stomach. The stomach becomes heated due to hunger and thirst. This heat will cause moist and surplus of other organs gather in the stomach. Thus, drinking warm water will wash these excesses and remove them. Otherwise, if food is eaten immediately, it will be mixed with the surplus and go back to other organs. This will cause ailments. A very important point at iftar is to refrain from drinking cold water. It is just like pouring cold water on a hot china dish. The china dish will crack. The same will happen to the stomach. The best thing to have for iftar is to eat a few dates with a glass of warm water. Fig and olive are also good to eat at iftar and sahari, which is pre-dawn meal. Olive and its oil are very useful for the heart and blood vessels. Regular consumption of olive oil increases high-density lipoprotein, that is HDL, and decreases low-density lipoprotein, that is LDL, reduces weight and prevents from fatness. Fig is also rich with calcium, iron, magnesium, potassium, and so on. It is also rich with fiber. Thus, besides keeping the health of digestive system, it normalizes the blood sugar. Moreover, fig is an alkaline fruit, which keeps the pH of body normal and thwarts the effects of harmful acids that have been produced during hunger and thirst. Sleep is very important during the fasting month of Ramadan. Moderate sleep will cause equation among neural centers. It will also increase moisture in body. Long sleeplessness will lead to dryness of body. Average sleep should be between 6 to 8 hours and must not exceed 10 hours. It is good to sleep after the noon and afternoon prayers in Ramadan to compensate short sleep of nights. The best time for sleep is when the stomach has digested the food completely and sent it to the bowels. Usually it takes 2 to 3 hours for the food to leave the stomach. We are in the final hours of Ramadan. Happy is he who has made use of the hours and moments of this blessed month and has been a good guest of God in his banquet. Happy is he who has been successful in gaining virtues and lofty merits. Blessed is he who has performed his deeds sincerely only for God's sake. Imam Hussein's son, Imam Sajjad, peace upon him, says in a beautiful supplication to bid farewell to Ramazan, O God, the month of Ramazan lived among us while it was praised, and it was a good helper for us, and it granted us the most precious benefits of the world people. But as its time is over and its days expired, it intends to leave. O God, now we are bidding it farewell as a farewell to a dearest whose departure is hard for us and whose going saddens us. Farewell on month which came with ample blessings and washed us of the pollutions of sin. How many evils left us with your coming and how much goodness we received. O God, greet Muhammad and progeny of Muhammad. We are sad at the passing by of this month. You grant us good reward on this departure.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
As the end of Ramadan slowly approaches, so do the celebrations of Quds Day. So people from all across the world take to the streets in a show of support for Palestine, to express their love for the holy city of Jerusalem or El Quds, and to express their firm opposition to Zionism and Israeli occupation. Now, given the recent crackdowns, the attacks by Israel in the occupied West Bank, and of course, the attacks against worshippers in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The marches, the commemorations, the celebrations of Quds Day are frankly more relevant than ever. So let's take a look at how Quds Day came into being, how it spread and grew in popularity to become what is really an international event, and why it is more relevant today than ever before in the face of Israel's illegal occupation of Al-Quds and oppression of Palestinians. I'm your host, Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Now, before we get into Quds Day and what it means, history behind it, how it came into being, I wanted to take just a tiny moment, just a brief moment, to maybe go into the word itself, right? Because usually when people talk about the capital of Palestine, they say Jerusalem. But in Arabic, in Persian, in Urdu, in Turkish, and in many languages, we don't say Jerusalem, we say Al-Quds. Now, the word Quds is actually a very ancient word. It's a Semitic word. You see it used even in Aramaic and Ugaritic, and you know, back then and still to this day, Quds means holy, right? It can also mean purity or blessing. In Arabic, when you say Muqaddas, it means blessed or holy. When we say Jerusalem, we say Al Quds or Al Bayt Al Muqaddas, the holy home or holy house. When Christians refer to the Bible in Arabic, they say Al-Kitab Al-Muqaddas. It means the holy book. And so the city itself, Jerusalem or Al-Quds, its very name being associated with the word holy really speaks volumes. I think it really says a lot of how special this city is for all the main three monotheistic religions, right? Of course, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. The Jews, they have the Western Wall. The Christians have the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Al-Quds is, of course, where Jesus Christ preached, was crucified, and then resurrected. And the Muslims have Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the third holiest site in Islam. And it's very, very important because in Islam, the Isra and Mi'raj is a night journey that took place in two parts, where the Prophet Muhammad goes from Mecca to Al-Quds, and then in the second part of that journey, the Mi'raj, he ascends to heaven and speaks to God, and God gives him instructions to take back to the Muslims regarding the details of prayer. Now, most people today living in the old city are, of Al-Quds are, of course, Palestinian, but you'll find Palestinian Jews and Palestinian Christians and Palestinian Muslims, and you can see how the city plays such an integral, crucial, central role for all these main religions, and you can see why it holds not just a powerful sentimental value, but theological and historical value for the people of the Middle East and West Asia. You know, this is home. And even the United Nations recognized this fact. The United Nations initially wanted Jerusalem, wanted Al-Quds to be a separate body, or in Latin, as they say, corpus separatum. Now, the Israelis love to say that, oh, we're a legitimate state because the UN recognizes us as a member state, and that's where they like to derive their legitimacy from. But they conveniently leave out the part where the United Nations said, get out of the Syrian Golan Heights, get out of Al-Quds. Your attempts to legally annex the Golan Heights and Al-Quds are null and void, are illegal. You have no right to declare Jerusalem as the capital of Israel or to change its status. You know, that part they conveniently leave out. And they, of course, try to blame this on the Palestinians. They say, the Israelis say, why didn't the Arabs just accept the partition plan? But they leave out that part of the partition plan, right? That's very convenient. And again, I don't see why when somebody comes into your house and says, I will take away half of your house, why you should accept that. But this is their logic. They think that Arabs and Palestinians should have simply accepted this partition plan. But in any case, you know, the idea behind Al-Quds is that it is such a special city. It's so integral to all these religions that it should remain under a neutral international regime. Now, obviously, the Israelis don't care for that. They've been illegally occupying Al-Quds since 1967. The United Nations has passed numerous Security Council resolutions demanding that Israel withdraws from the territories such as Al-Quds and Syria's Golan Heights. Resolution 242, which was passed unanimously by all members of the UN Security Council, including the United States and France and Britain, calls for, quote, withdrawal of Israel armed forces from territories occupied in the recent conflict. So it's crystal clear. Israel has, of course, ignored this resolution and countless others. It not only illegally continues to illegally occupy Al-Quds, but it illegally annexed it too in July 1980 in what the Israelis call the so-called Jerusalem Law. Now, the month after that, in August 1980, the United Nations Security Council adopted Resolution 478 condemning Israel and calling its Jerusalem Law, quote, null and void. Israel has not only continued to illegally occupy Al-Quds in violation of international law, but also continues to brutalize and oppress Palestinians. We've seen, for example, this campaign in the East Jerusalem district of Sheikh Jarrah to evict Palestinians from their homes so that Jewish settlers from all over, from the United States and wherever, can come in. Under what authority? These Israeli courts have no jurisdiction in Al-Quds to begin with, right? They have no authority, no legal right. They are kangaroo courts, for lack of a better term. And then, of course, there's the violence, right? The other brutality. So not just the evictions, but the beatings of Palestinians at Damascus Gate during Ramadan, in or around Al-Aqsa Mosque. Last year, in May 2021, a war broke out in Gaza, leaving 2,000 Palestinians wounded and 240 dead. As a result of all of this, and this year, Israel has continued the exact same behavior. Israeli forces enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which, again, is the third holiest site in Islam. They fire tear gas, rubber bullets at worshippers while they're praying during the holy month of Ramadan. I mean, you cannot think of a more hostile act. And so Israel is not only desecrating this holy site, but also causing terrible damage, irreparable damage to the priceless windows and architecture. Remember, the Aqsa Mosque has stood in Al-Quds for over 1,000 years. And yet look at how they walk in and fire, you know, tear gas, and how they behave in this place and just recklessly destroy it. Many videos emerged outside Al-Aqsa Mosque as well, in the compound, of Israelis beating journalists who are covering this violent assault. You know, so much for freedom of the press, right? They love to say that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. And this is how they treat journalists. They beat them. Another video, of course, of an Israeli beating this Palestinian man in front of his child for no apparent reason. We also saw another harrowing video of this poor Palestinian woman being beaten, again, for no reason. And her arm was broken as a result. And she's howling in pain. I mean, what kind of behavior is this? You know, when we see these images, these acts of violence, and the sheer injustice and unfairness of it all, that's why people rally behind Palestine and rally at Quds Day to support the Palestinians in their cause. And this, of course, is to say nothing of the numerous Israeli raids that took place simultaneously in the past weeks in Jenin, in Nablus, and in other parts of the occupied West Bank, killing numerous Palestinian civilians. You know, in another heartbreaking death, Ghada Sabatin, a Palestinian mother of six, she was shot dead by the Israelis in early April. She was unarmed, she was visually impaired, and she was shot in the leg because she didn't obey some order by the Israeli occupation forces, and they prevented medical and emergency services from saving her, and as a result, she bled to death on the road. She was a widow, and that means that her six children are now left without both of their parents. And so once again, it's this kind of brutality that has made people all around the world realize that what's happening to Palestinians is a grave and terrible injustice. And that's why in 1979, Quds Day was created in Iran at the initiative of Imam Khomeini. This followed, of course, the Islamic Revolution that took place the same year in Iran. And one of the main central themes of Iran's revolution has always been the idea that you stand with the oppressed, right? And since then, Iran has been one of the biggest supporters of the Palestinian cause, to the point that it really puts some Arab leaders to shame, quite honestly, right? Iran supports the liberation of Palestine on so many levels, culturally, politically, militarily. And the International Quds Day is an expression of that very support. It's a call to come together to reiterate support for Palestinian self-determination, liberation, and to oppose Zionism. And so this is an event that basically promotes decolonization, right? It promotes values that people associate with human rights, you know, self-determination, liberation. And Palestinians have been living under Israeli occupation since 1948. And this unchecked brutality, I mean, that would be bad enough anywhere, but the fact it's taking place in such a holy city, in Al-Quds itself, it really shows how much contempt and disdain the Israelis have towards the local Palestinian population. And it's impossible to look at this and not feel compassion. And so that's why Al-Quds Day is very important for the Muslim and the Arab world, the Ummah. And every year, there are parades to mark this occasion in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iran, in Palestine. And while Quds Day is certainly something that's predominantly celebrated and observed in the countries of the axis of resistance, it has grown tremendously in popularity and spread all over the world. So just in the last few years alone, you've had Quds Day marches in London, in Toronto, in Berlin, in Chicago, in Cape Town. And that shows you the meaning behind Al-Quds Day. You know, this is something that really resonates with people worldwide, because when people understand what Palestinians are going through, what Zionism means, then they begin to rally behind this cause, behind the Palestinians, and support their national liberation. So Quds Day is a strong and potent expression of that, of what it means to stand with the oppressed and against the oppressor. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
I spoke earlier to Batul Subeiti. She's an energy engineer and political analyst that's based in London in the UK. And she's written for numerous outlets such as the Tehran Times, Al Mayadeen, and Press TV. She attended this year's Quds Day March in London and told me about her experiences there and why she decided to turn out.
The establishment of Al-Quds Day, it centralized the Palestinian cause as the cause in which all the people of the world should unite. And so Palestine represents that focal point of unity, not just between the Muslims themselves, but all the justice seekers of the world. Imam Khomeini said that the destinies of the oppressed nations need to be determined. It's a day in which we need to be discussing the solutions for Palestinian liberation. And ultimately, you see this happening in Al-Quds Day, right? You see it through the chants. You see it through the nature of the speeches that are given, which they don't hide away from the reality on the ground. They don't hide away from the fact that we shouldn't be pacifists in the face of aggression, and that the only way to actually liberate Palestine is, if we're talking on the ground, it's not through slogans of, you know, we need to sanction European, for example, nations that are complicit, right, when they are literally the ones arming them. But it's no, you have to force that change. You have to structurally enact that change on the ground such that you cause harm to the interests of Israel, to the point where it will consider actually foregoing this occupation, or you jeopardize the interests of America more so, to the point where it will consider foregoing sustaining Israel. And so these kinds of chants are raised, you know, the slogan of armed struggle and armed resistance. And because of that, you know, you have a lot of counter demonstrations, usually huge hefty efforts by even the government to try and ban this march, right? Under the title that they raised concepts of resistance. And I mean, this was also in light of the fact that they prescribed the Resistance to Lebanon as a terrorist organization, the political wing, in 2019. Hence, they're using that tactic to therefore criminalize people coming out on the streets chanting for the liberation of Palestine and being realistic about it. And that's the crucial point that I want to make here, is they are realistic when they're saying only armed struggle and armed resistance will lead to liberation. Nothing else in that reality matters. Then we have the case study of South Lebanon and how that was achieved. And it seems like that case study is almost never spoken about because it's so powerful and because of the ramifications that it has.
Now, Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, he usually gives a speech on Quds Day. And just to underscore again the importance of Quds Day, when Nasrallah gives the speech, this is one of the most important speeches of the year. Right, this is something that people look forward to. And this year he said something very, very interesting. He said that the axis of resistance, meaning the countries that resist Western imperialism and Zionism, like Iran, like Syria, like Yemen, Lebanon, Palestine, they're not just the axis of resistance, but the axis of Al-Quds. What did you think of his statement? Do you think that victory is closer than ever? Do you think that as a whole, not just the Palestinian resistance itself, the axis of resistance, but people's consciousness globally is at a different stage than it used to be before? Are their eyes open to what's happening in Al-Quds and in the Middle East and West Asia?
Oppression is unsustainable, right? Because oppression is not sustainable, it is bound to end, right? It can't sustain itself, because there reaches a breaking point. And I think we've at least history has seen that with every case of every arrogant tyrant and every oppressor, their time has come to an end. Again, the reason that Al-Quds is being put forward, I think, and is being centralized and is being made to be the axis of all kinds of oppression, because Al-Quds in many ways alludes to, you can argue, the biggest shame that has ever occurred in humanity occurred in Palestine because of the magnitude of the oppression. The final point that you made in terms of people's consciousness waking up, 110%, and that has certainly been helped with the tools that we have, which is why cyber warfare and cyber activism is so important, and why the leader of the resistance himself mentions that. He literally says, go out on your keyboards, type what you need to type, raise the message, normalize concepts. The battle, before the battle is had on the field, it's a battle of the minds and the hearts, right? No one will fight for a cause unless they truly believe it and they've internalized it. And that should be our job.
You know, just to contrast this, the Quds Day that we are talking about, which was created in support of Palestine, it represents support for national liberation, for self-determination, opposition to colonialism and Zionism. Meanwhile, Israel's so-called Jerusalem Day celebrates an illegal invasion, annexation, and military occupation of a holy city. Now, between these two, which do you think the West has tried to ban? The one calling for liberation, for equality, for human rights, or the one that celebrates illegal occupation and annexation? Now, of course, you can guess, there have been many attempts in the West to ban Quds Day marches in support of Palestinians, because the Israeli lobby and Israel's allies don't want people to find out about their crimes, and don't want people don't want support for Palestinians to grow. And so in 2021, Berlin banned the annual Quds Day march. You've had petitions in the UK as well trying to outlaw it, and of course many hit pieces and smear pieces in the media trying to paint it as some sort of terrorist sympathizer or a Jew-hating event. All sorts of nasty things just to distract and change the subject away from Palestinian self-determination.
So in terms of the attempts to ban the march, the Home Office received several letters. This was even prior to 2019. I think it was 2018, when a man named Darren Osborne, who's a far-right radical fascist in the UK, he claimed prior to the march that he wanted to actually go into the march and run some protesters over, right? And so rather than doing that in the march, he then directed his efforts to Finsbury Park Mosque. For some logistical reasons, I think it didn't work out for him. But I'm saying that's the extent to which they see the threat of it. And the establishment did nothing in order to protect the protesters. I literally mean nothing. When you go to the march, you see how even the Met Police, like the police in the UK, the way that they treat even the protesters, for example, with contempt, right? And the way that they, for example, come close to them, they try to ask them questions. And it's like, rather than protecting them, right, you feel like they're doing the opposite, right? You see them stationed across the side where there are the Zionists trying to ultimately protect them. And it's no surprise, to be honest, when this is a systemic issue which comes from the top. Now, obviously, their efforts to criminalize the protest hasn't been successful, because I think they also fear the huge backlash that will come as a result of that. I think they should know by now that if they try to criminalize it, it won't stop people coming out on the streets, and that might cause them greater injury. I mean, how many people are they willing to arrest? 5,000 people on the streets? I don't think so.
Now, the attempts to ban Quds Day are rooted in the same smear tactics that you usually see. Right, anyone who criticizes Israel and expresses support for Palestinians is labeled an anti-Semite. which A, is very confusing because Palestinians and Arabs are themselves Semites who speak a Semitic language. And B, this is a protest against Zionism, not against Judaism. Judaism is a religion that dates back thousands of years. Meanwhile, Zionism is a political ideology that was created in Europe in the late 19th century. And C, there are Jews who come to participate in the Quds Day marches. This is a clip right here of Orthodox Jews burning the Israeli flag at a Quds Day march. So are you going to come now and accuse them of being anti-Semites as well? Now, Batul raises a great point because she says, why should we entertain these attacks in the first place? People defending Palestinians themselves don't have anything to explain. And weaponizing their struggle is a very disingenuous thing to do. The only ones that need to do any explaining and be held accountable are the perpetrators of occupation and genocide.
So the whole argument of anti-Semitism, I mean, the way that I put it, and very simply, it's like comparing apples and oranges, honestly. And I think the more that we start to kind of justify that we're not anti-Semitic, I feel like that's playing into the issue, right? Because it's such a contradiction in the way that it came about. I mean, the antagonists of the Zionists during the early 20th century were the Jews themselves. Zionism began as a Christian project before it was a Jewish project, and it was the evangelicals who were the Jew-hating, if you like. The way that they justified it is, you know, if we want to precipitate the second coming of the Messiah, that means the resurrection of the dead, and the Jews, either they become Christians or go to hell, right? That was their philosophy behind it. And so it's the last thing that they care about is really and truly facilitating this kind of Zionist dream. It's actually Jew hatred that takes them in that direction. I mean, the only reason that I'm saying this is just to show the inherent hypocrisy, the inherent contradiction, and the inherent weaponization of using another people's suffering as a political tool. That is what we need to be doing. That is what we need to be calling out. It's like, how dare you do that? How dare you weaponize an entire faith, right? What do you think the people of the world are now starting or will start to do if they look towards an entity like Israel that's claiming to be Jew, right? That is using the name of Judaism as a cover, right? In the same way that, for example, Daesh used the name of Islam. I mean, one of the reasons that the West gave prominent rise to Daesh is to obviously hit the line of the resistance front, right? But the line of the resistance front, right, was spearheaded by Iran, which is the Shia nation. So they consider Daesh to be the best candidate to fight that version of Islam that's a threat to them. The point that I want to make is, in terms of the Jews themselves, we need to, you know, speak about how this actually might cause them injury, right? The moment that Israel gets associated with Judaism and people see it from that lens, is that is wrong. Because people will start to think that is Judaism, but that clearly isn't, right? Those people that are simple-minded and can't see beyond the narrative. And ultimately, that's also to create the point that they don't care. Like, they don't care about Jewish suffering, right? They're just weaponizing it.
And so on this Quds Day, no matter the form, many people, you know, they're coming out, they're hoping, they're praying for the liberation of Al-Quds, the eternal holy city and capital of Palestine. And they hope to see the Palestinian people free, healthy, and happy. And, you know, the fight against colonialism, fighting for national liberation, fighting on behalf or on the side of the oppressed, it's a marathon, right? It's a long-term effort, and it requires stamina and drive and resilience and resolve. And resistance can take many forms, right? Some people resist on the battlefield, others resist with their words, with their ideas. And as they say, the pen is mightier than the sword. Now, with that said, this right here, this is the last episode of the communique of season one. I know the subject matter, I know the things that we cover are not always the happiest and the brightest in nature, but nevertheless, it's been a pleasure for me to navigate all of these complex issues with you, from Palestine to Yemen to Syria to Lebanon to the Belt and Road Initiative, the elections in Venezuela, the elections in Syria, in Iran, in the United States, covering the Julian Assange case on the ground, covering the Iran nuclear deal on the ground, bringing you all of this original reporting to you right here on a weekly basis. Unquestionably, it's a huge honor and privilege for me, not just to host the communique, but to have helped create and produce it and be given this platform to promote the voices of the oppressed, to counter the imperialist corporate mainstream media, and to hopefully make a difference in the world. And while it seems like goodbye, don't worry, it's not, because we'll be right back right here after just a short break, and I really hope to see you all soon. for season 2, inshallah. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
In the limelight.
Palestinians are now capable of responding in a unified fashion and, despite their limited means, even putting pressure on Israeli regime to reverse its policies, says Ramzi Baru, journalist, in an article titled Temporal and Spatial Division: Why Israeli Regime's Endgame at Al-Aqsa Mosque Will Fail. Stay tuned for more. Starting on April 15th, the Israeli Regime Occupation Army and police raided Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied East Al-Quds on a daily basis. Under the pretense of providing protection to provocative visits by thousands of illegal Israeli Jewish settlers and right-wing fanatics, the Israeli Regime Army has wounded hundreds of Palestinians, including journalists, and arrested hundreds more. Palestinians understand that the current attacks on Al-Aqsa carry deeper political and strategic meanings for the Zionist regime than previous raids. Al-Aqsa has experienced routine raids by the Zionist regime